Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 13th of September, Monday at 9, all things political, a big political week in Wisconsin and in other states in the country with the primaries tomorrow. Craig Gilbert is joining us the first hour of our program today, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We'll also be talking about the midterm elections. Will they be a disaster for the Democrats? The president has been a little bit more forceful with his language starting on Labor Day here in Milwaukee. We'll talk about whether or not the economy can recover in a short 2 month period of time, what it is he could do to set the economy on a road to greater prosperity and oomph, and whatever else you'd like to talk about. We will concentrate on a couple Wisconsin races, the first part of our program today, because the Republican gubernatorial race may appear to be a little closer than people thought it was. So we will discuss that and welcome your phone calls. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we'd like to hear from you about your thoughts concerning the gubernatorial race here in the state of Wisconsin as we approach a primary day tomorrow. Do you think it will be closer? It was thought that Walker would probably walk away with this race. Do you think it will be closer than people had thought just a couple months ago? Is there a chance that Mark Newman will win this race? We welcome your phone calls and your emails. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Good morning, Craig Gilbert. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Good morning. Good. I'm glad to hear that. So let's start with this gubernatorial race on the Republican side in Wisconsin. Do the ads suggest, Craig, that this is a closer race than everybody would have thought a couple months ago?
Yes, they do. I remember Tad Devine, one of the guys who ran John Kerry's media campaign in 2004 when John Kerry was running for president, said after the campaign that if you want to understand a candidate's strategy, look at their media buy. It doesn't lie.
Mm.
And I think what it tells us about Scott Walker is that there's some nervousness there, that they saw something in their polling that made them nervous, some movement by Mark Newman. I don't know how close the race is because I haven't seen any polling data, but for Scott Walker, I mean, every dollar you spend against Mark Newman is a dollar that you can't spend against Tom Barrett if you're the nominee. So the only reason to go negative on Mark Newman at this stage of a primary campaign is that you don't want to take any chances or that you're really, really nervous about the polling trend.
Well, where is the polling trend? Usually we see poll after poll after poll. Why haven't we seen any in the last couple days?
Well, it's a primary, and there's a lot less public polling in primary campaigns. In this case, this is a primary that, as you noted, people where there's been a clear expectation about the outcome. So I think there's been less, kind of incentive to spend money on public polling in this race than otherwise. And also, it's hard to poll in primaries. You don't know. It's harder to figure out exactly who's going to vote, to identify the kind of likely voting electorate, and primary polls are, for that reason, generally less reliable than general election polls. So we don't have any public data. What we have to go on is what the candidates are doing.
Mm-hmm. I don't watch a ton of television, but I do watch the news every day and a little bit of television during the course of the evening. It seems to me as though there much be, and I don't know if you have figures on this, a huge difference between the amount of money that Newman is spending on ads compared to Walker. I see a lot of Newman ads. Did he spend a lot more? Do you know?
Well, we don't know yet because we haven't seen the reports for the period of time we're talking about yet. So I don't know the answer to your question. I mean, the difference is that Newman is spending a lot of his own money. And so
right.
He has the ability, when you've got deep pockets, I mean, you can make spending decisions on the fly, and when you're fundraising from outside donors, you're really dependent on the money that's coming in. And again, in Walker's case, He's got two considerations. I mean, he's trying to win the primary, but he's also trying to position himself for the general election. And so as the favorite in the primary, he's got to balance those two things. And if he spends all his money now, he's not going to have it, or he's going to have less of it to spend in a general election.
Right. Are there major differences, Craig, on some policy issues between Newman and Walker?
I don't think there are. I mean, I think there are some differences in, you know, when you get down to the weeds of the policy agenda. But basically, you know, it's interesting. In some of the other races where one candidate in the Republican primary has kind of snuck up on the other and surprised them, there's been a much clearer contrast politically between the two Republicans. You've had sort of an establishment Republican and an insurgent Republican, and there hasn't been much doubt about who's who. You saw that in Alaska, where Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator, lost a Republican primary to Joe Miller, kind of the insurgent candidate. We're seeing that in Delaware, which also votes on Tuesday, where mm-hmm. Mike Castle, a pretty very moderate Republican, who has been the big favorite, is facing a challenge from a Tea Party candidate who's not very well funded, but who's, according to one poll that just published today, who's neck and neck in this race. And in the case of Newman and Walker, even though Newman is running as sort of the outsider, and he does have a business career, he has spent 4 years in Congress, and he's run many times for political office. He lost a statewide election campaign in 1998 to Russ Feingold, and he lost campaigns for Congress before he won campaigns for Congress. So he's got a political history. He's not a newcomer in that sense, but he can sort of plausibly argue that he's more of an outsider than Walker, because Walker has been has pretty much spent his career by and large in politics.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, and just to add, and on top of that, the fact that there's not, you know, an obvious ideological contrast between them, you know. This isn't a situation where there's a moderate Republican running against a conservative Republican. These are two conservative Republicans running against each other.
Right. And speaking of turnout, because it's always turnout, isn't it? Whoever keeps track of these things is saying yesterday that we could see a record turnout for a primary tomorrow. So there must be a lot of interest in this race. Do you think there will be a record turnout, and what would prompt that?
I'm a little skeptical of predictions like that. I mean, I don't know what to think about that, because I can tell you there's been a lot of occasions in the past where we've had record turnouts predicted that haven't materialized. On the other hand, this is an unusual political year where, you know, most of the energy and intensity is on the Republican side. So in that sense, you know, there's certainly a scenario for that kind of Republican interest driving a pretty high turnout when you've got a Republican primary for governor, and you've got a primary, at least one wide open Republican primary for Congress in northeastern Wisconsin. You've got some other things on the ballot, but I'd just be a little bit cautious about predictions of record turnout.
Mm-hmm. On the Democratic side, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that Tom Barrett, Mayor Barrett, will win the primary unless something totally unforeseen should happen. He started an ad that's quite dramatic last week. I know you've probably seen it, as our listeners have as well, using the character issue and the attack, the vicious attack on him at State Fair last week, showing picture of his face and news coverage, and then Chris Barrett, his wife, talking about who he was during that, and that's the kind of person that he is. Is it an effective ad?
I think it's a well-done ad. And you got to remember, in Barrett's case, everybody in Milwaukee is really familiar with his story, but he's running for statewide office, and so he has done a lot of his advertising outside the Milwaukee TV market. And so I think he's trying to make sure that voters outside this media market know his story, and, you know, know him, and obviously they want to put this part of the story forward. I think the Democrats, you know, let's face it, on paper, this is a pretty bad scenario for them in this governor's race. I mean, not only is it a good year generically for Republicans and a bad year for Democrats, but On top of that, we've had 8 years of a Democratic governor, Jim Doyle, who is not particularly popular, judging from the opinion polls right now. And whenever you've had a long incumbency in one party, there's a tendency for voters to look to the other party. And so everything on paper is kind of bad. Mitigates against the Democratic victory in this governor's race. And so for Democrats, their hope, their victory scenario is that their candidate, you know, on a more personal level, turns out to be a more appealing candidate than the Republican candidate and runs a better campaign. And whether or not that spells victory, even if it turns out to be true, is an open question. But that's sort of their path to victory.
Yeah. It is quite a story, isn't it? The more you think about it, it is quite a story.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. And I can't think of anything, any kind of parallel
right.
to it in Wisconsin politics, certainly, and not too many in national politics. I mean, certainly we've had candidates, and not to make any parallels here at all, but we've certainly had candidates at the national level who've had a compelling personal story, like John McCain, his time as a POW, and where you had sort of this issue of how is he going to handle it, how is he going to use that story, is there a danger in being too direct
right.
In promoting yourself with this story? Does everybody know it well enough sufficiently that you don't need to do that? I mean, those are the kinds of considerations for a campaign. In this case, Barrett, again, is not that well known outside the Milwaukee market, and I think they wanted to define him for those voters.
Right. I think of Joe Biden, too, and his horrendous personal story and how that was used, you know, in some ways, but it wasn't offensive.
I'm sorry, which one?
Joe Biden.
What aspect?
The aspect of losing his wife, and it's horrible.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And again, it's tricky because, you know, there are probably cases, and I'm not sure what they are, where you could identify where it's backfired on a candidate.
Right. This will be an election that will play down the road, but I've heard this once. I've heard it 100 times from national commentators talking about the Johnson-Feingold race, that Feingold is in the race of his political life. This is the hardest race. It's really difficult. He could be upseated. He's the underdog. Is he?
I don't know if he's the underdog, but he is in a huge fight. And, you know, I guess if you define underdog as someone who's being outspent on television right now, you could say he's the underdog. I mean, there are advantages to incumbency as well. I mean, he's spent a lot of money over the years talking to Wisconsin voters, and he's had a lot of time not just through television, but also, you know, around the state, the town hall meetings, making himself known and communicating to people in the state. So even if you come in, you know, you could argue that a challenger needs to spend more money on television just to even the playing field. In this case, it's, you know, his challenger has a lot of money and is spending a lot of it. And so the disparity has been pretty large. I think everybody thinks by the end of the campaign that Feingold will have spent enough money to kind of run a adequate advertising campaign. But it makes a big difference if you're a challenger, if you can outspend the incumbent, because one thing that happens to a lot of challengers is right out of the gate, they're kind of hit with a barrage of negative ads that sort of define them for voters before they can define themselves. We've seen that time and time again. And if you can outshout your opponent, it's very difficult for that to happen. And so it's a form of challenger protection. It helps you fend off attacks, and it also helps you kind of make yourself known to people when you start out as a political unknown. So that's huge in this race. Mm-hmm. I mean, if that had been the case, if he'd gotten to sort of a generic traditional, you know, political challenger as a Republican, I think it would be a much different story.
And finally, from me, before we start going to phone calls. Well, the other thing that we keep hearing is that these midterm elections nationally will be a disaster for the Democrats. Do you think that's true, Craig?
I think they're going to be pretty bad. I mean, there's some debate in the political community about how bad. And there's a few wild cards here. We know the Republicans are going to turn out because every poll tells us that you know, Republicans are riled up and they're really, really interested in this election and they're really, really energized. There's a gap right now, an enthusiasm gap between the two parties. I mean, everybody's probably heard about this ad nauseum, but we don't know if the Democrats can do anything to sort of neutralize or narrow that gap. If they can, you know, they've shown in recent cycles that they have a good turnout operation. Obviously, in 2006 and 2008, Democrats really turned out. It's a more demoralized party base this time around. But we don't know how big that gap's going to be. If the gap is smaller rather than larger, then they can minimize their losses. At this point, you know, the expectations have begun to kind of run away for the Republicans, and anything short of a sweeping tidal victory, you know, will probably be regarded by some Republicans as a disappointment. But there is some suspense when it comes to the size of the Republican gains. And in Wisconsin, you know, the scenarios range from, at one end of the spectrum, a complete sort of wholesale shift in the balance of partisan power, where Republicans, you know, take away virtually everything from the Democrats, a Senate seat, the governor, both chambers of the legislature, a couple of federal congressional seats at one end of the spectrum. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you know, Democrats hold on to the Senate. They find a way somehow to win the governor's race, and they minimize their losses for federal and state legislature.
Craig Gilbert is our guest for All Things Political, with a big primary tomorrow in Wisconsin. At least on the Republican side, we thought that we would concentrate some on what's going on in our state, but also looking at the midterms, we have yet to talk about whether or not there's a change in tone in rhetoric from President Obama, and if there are signs that the economy is recovering, if he needs to make some major announcement about jobs, if the economy could recover or be perceived to be on the road of recovery before the November elections, which may help the Democrats, or if it's just too late for that, and why it is that the administration waited so long to take on this issue, which obviously is of great importance to people who live in this country. Well, let's go to your phone calls, okay? 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. If you want to share who you're going to vote for in tomorrow's primary, that would be okay. You know, today is the day you can do that. We'll be with your phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday, we'll be speaking with two award-winning Wisconsin librarians about the growth in library use. And even this is happening even though, as you well know, libraries have been suffering from cutbacks in funding all over the country. But the number of people who are getting library cards and using libraries for all kinds of purposes just keeps growing. So that's coming up, our number two of our show. Craig Gilbert is with us this first hour of the show, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and it's All Things Political. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We start our calls with Peter from Madison. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to ask Mr. Gilbert, which of the Democratic candidates for lieutenant governor helps the top of the ticket the most. In his opinion, we have two African Americans, one from Milwaukee, one from Dane County, and we have a legislator that I'm familiar with up in the Fox River Valley from Kirkcona. Is this geography? Is this ethnic boost or hindrance? So what's his spin on the lieutenant governor's race, please?
Okay, Peter, thanks.
You know, it's a good question. I do think, just to say up front, I mean, these kinds of impacts we're talking about are pretty marginal. I don't think, just like at the presidential level, you know, your choice of vice president doesn't have much of an effect on the vote for president. I don't think the identity of the lieutenant governor has much impact on the gubernatorial race. I think at the margins, you could. It's an interesting question. You could sort of make the case that having an African-American candidate coming out of Milwaukee, for example, might help Tom Barrett against Scott Walker. If Scott Walker is the Republican nominee, in simply in terms of driving up turnout in Milwaukee County, you know, Democrats, in order to win statewide, generally have to carry Milwaukee County by more than 60% of the two-party vote. And if they don't, they typically don't win. And so running against, again, if Scott Walker's the nominee, having two candidates from the Milwaukee area, it kind of raises the bar a little bit for a Democratic candidate who's the mayor of Milwaukee in terms of meeting that target in Milwaukee County. That's one way to look at it, but I think, you know, you could slice this one a couple of different ways. I think in the end, it just is pretty marginal in terms of its impact on the outcome of the governor's race.
Will they campaign together or not?
I don't know. I mean, it's kind of because they're not, they're not starting out as a ticket in this case. It's a little bit different. You know, it may depend on the relationship between the candidates, and there'll be some sort of political calculus involved in how they affect each other, and you know, whether they're better off campaigning individually or together.
There's also the obvious question of why do so many people want to be lieutenant governor?
Well, I can think of at least two lieutenant governors who've become governors,
okay,
in recent memory, or at least in memory, Scott McCallum, when Tommy Thompson was selected for the Bush cabinet in 2000, and Marty Schreiber, when Pat Lucey was made ambassador to Mexico, if I have that right, in the 1970s,
right.
Jimmy Carter. So it can happen. I mean, it can be a path to career advancement. On the other hand, there's a little bit of a stigma associated with being lieutenant governor in the sense that, you know, people understand that you have no power and you don't get the respect and you don't necessarily have the stature you might associate with statewide office. So both people I mentioned, you know, failed failed to hold on to the governor's office by running on their own. And so I think that tells you that it's a mixed blessing.
We go next. Thanks, Peter, for your call. Teresa in Stoughton. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. On a slightly different topic within this topic.
Could you get just a little closer to your phone, please?
Oh, sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay, sorry. I'm calling because of something that I heard recently, and it's just been really troubling me, and I'm wondering if your guests can speak to it at all. It's about a newly formed right-wing group called American Action Network, and they specifically were formed to funnel millions of dollars into Republican coffers, and they're the ones going after Russ Feingold right now. And I just saw the ad for Johnson running against Feingold last night, and I was so outraged. And I'm just wondering if your guest knows anything about the American Action Network. And I mean, there are people from, there's someone from Goldman Sachs. These are multimillionaires supporting these attacks.
And what's the basis of the attack, Teresa?
Well, the ad last night, running down Feingold, saying that he's responsible for the debt. And that he's never held a job in his life.
Mm.
These are false.
Yeah, I think that's a Johnson ad that you're referring to, unless I'm wrong. I mean, the American Action Network is a group that has spent money against Feingold. The last time I saw good numbers on it, which was at the end of August, they had spent several hundred thousand dollars in the race, but that was sort of a drop in the bucket compared to what Ron Johnson had spent, which was about $4 million at that point in time. So it isn't to say that they're going to, you know, end up spending a lot more money than that by the end of the race. They are a national Republican group that has targeted certain races. You know, if you go to their website, you'll see some familiar names when it comes to, you know, the people that are involved in the group. But I think that by far the majority of money that's been spent on the Senate race has been by the candidate Ron Johnson. It's going to be interesting to see how much outside activity there is on both the right and the left in this particular race.
There will be a lot, I expect. Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, one of the guys who helped found the American Action Network is Doug Holtzeken, who was John McCain's sort of principal economic policy advisor in the 2008 campaign. Norm Coleman's another guy who's involved. He's a former Republican senator from Minnesota. So they've targeted a sort of a handful of Senate races so far, and they've raised a fair amount of money. And this is not something new in politics. I mean, we've had groups on both the right and the left do this in recent cycles. They have a fair amount of leeway under the campaign finance laws to get involved this way, and this could end up being kind of a big year for independent groups.
Right. What's this phrase? It doesn't bother me if somebody's in politics for a long period of time. I tend to use that phrase, public servant, be these people Democrats or Republicans. This using a phrase career politician doesn't resonate with me as being a negative thing, but it must resonate with some people. Is that an effective criticism of someone? Does it resonate with a lot of people?
Well, I think certainly the people that run these campaigns think it's an effective slogan.
Right.
It's not, again, that's not new either. I mean, we've seen this cycle after cycle. And it drives some incumbent politicians crazy. I'm sure it drives Russ Feingold crazy because, you know, from their point of view, they're in public service for a reason. I think they're thinking to themselves, man, I could make a lot more money.
Sure.
And have a lot more fun doing something else. And certainly, you know, they have their own reasons as well for being in public service. So I don't want to be too kind of rosy about it. But the fact is it's in years when there's a lot of public discontent, this is a very popular theme. And it doesn't matter which party is doing it. I mean, you know, Ron Johnson is attacking Russ Feingold as a career politician, and Russ Feingold's thinking to himself, well, what about, you know, all his Republican buddies are career politicians.
Right.
I mean, what does he think about Jim Sensenbrenner and all the other guys on his side? He's not attacking them. What about Scott Walker? I mean, it's interesting because if you have Scott Walker on the ticket as a Republican candidate for governor, and if you have Ron Johnson running against career politicians as the Republican candidate for Senate, there's a little bit of dissonance there between those messages. But the same thing, you know, happens on the Democratic side, too. I mean, it's sort of politics or campaign messaging 101, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Teresa. We go to Aaron next from Milwaukee. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess the main concern that I have is I was listening to, I think, 360, I can't remember exactly the name of the program, but on cable, but they're talking about the Koch brothers and how they have kind of become the puppet masters in the background of the Tea Party. And people, they try to keep their distance, but they're an oil company or the benefactors of an oil company, and they basically have all these self-interests. They're against the environment. They're against, you know, campaign finance and all that kind of things. And I just would like you to kind of talk about them a little bit. And people need to be informed about them because they're planting the seeds of resentment against the Democrats, and I don't think that a lot of what they're talking about is accurate. So thank you.
Thanks very much for your call, Aaron.
Yeah, I think, there's always a combination in these, you know, movements and campaigns and insurgencies of sort of bottom-up and top-down. And in this case, you've got a lot of bottom-up energy and emotion and mobilization going on in the sort of Tea Party conservative movement. And you also have top-down organizing and money happening as well. I mean, there have been some groups that have stepped in in a more professional way and tried to channel the energy out there at the grassroots level into mobilization, into advertising, and you've got big pockets as well. And again, I don't want to suggest that this is unique to Republicans, because and you can go back to recent cycles where there's been a lot of Republican complaints about deep pocket Democratic donors who've spent a lot of money financing. You certainly saw it in 2004 financing independent advertising campaigns. In the presidential race, for example, so it does happen on both sides. I think it is certainly important for the media to kind of cover that part of the process and to sort of let people know and try to let people know, you know, where's the money coming from and what interests are involved when it comes to stuff like this. It's not something unique to this race. But it is it's worth thinking about, and it's worth reporting on where the money's coming from and what interests are being represented.
Right. Thanks, Aaron. Kathy in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it speaks volumes about how ill-informed the electorate is that so much depends on multiple millions of dollars being raised for advertising, especially those misleading, sometimes funny, but usually kind of misleading, 30 to 60-second TV spots. It's pathetic. If I can't imagine anyone actually makes up their mind who to vote for based on a TV ad, but I suppose a lot of people do. And I suppose this is one reason I would like to see public financing of campaigns. That's my comment. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Thanks, Kathy.
Well, you know, I think when you look at something like, for example, when you look at presidential campaigns, television advertising, even though it gets a tremendous amount of attention, has pretty marginal effects because people have so much information they're getting from other sources, from news sources. They're paying more attention. Their voting choices are kind of more conditioned by their political ideology or their identification with a particular party. But when you talk about further down the ballot and you talk about races for governor and races for senator and races for Congress, then it becomes more and more influential. And those are the campaigns where television ads do make a big difference because people do pay less attention to those races. They're less, they know less about the candidates. They, are more susceptible to persuasion. And in many cases, that persuasion is coming through the TV screen. I mean, one of the twists in this discussion in this particular year is that we're talking about Russ Feingold's Senate campaign, and of course he's been at the forefront of efforts to regulate campaign finance, and he has been successful in some respects in that effort. I mean, passing the sort of landmark campaign finance law with John McCain, which affected, the way the parties can raise money and also affected what third-party groups can do on television. And then he's also watched a part
Hello?
Ratify the law the first time around. The Supreme Court has kind of systematically peeled it back in a series of decisions. And now we're seeing outside groups have more leeway than they did a few years ago in what they can do on television with their money.
She has a point at face value. It's just weird the way that we have so much money spent on so many ads, and you do see the same thing over and over and over and over. It's kind of a weird thing the way we do that in elections, isn't it? Instead of just getting together.
Yeah, and it's sort of an interesting, just from a political science point of view, it's kind of an open question as to how effective all this stuff is. I mean, the media environment is changing so rapidly, and people talk about the audience being fragmented, and this is sort of a challenge for the advertisers as well, is how do you sort of chase that audience when now it's watching 200 channels instead of four or five, and getting their information from all sorts of media, television, and the kind of fallback response is on the part of the campaigns is just to sort of spend more money the way
right. They've
been spending it in the past. In addition to trying to do some new and different things, they're also just trying to do more of it. Evan Tracy, who has this company in Northern Virginia, who tracks all the television spending, all the ad spending, says it's sort of like, you know, going to Paris and speaking English louder in an effort to make yourself understood to French people. I think that's a pretty good metaphor.
It is.
And that's what you're seeing on TV. And the more that everybody spends, the more sort of clutter and noise it creates, and the harder it is for any of these candidates individually to kind of punch through that clutter and be heard and be remembered, and which also kind of feeds kind of a creates a demand for sort of over-the-top advertising that you know, sticky advertising that people will remember. So it's
Craig,
kind of a funny dynamic, and we'll have some perspective after the election is over. Obviously, not all big spending television saturation campaigns are successful. I mean, some are, and everybody would rather have more money and more ads than less ads if you're a candidate. But there's also the history of these campaigns is also littered with lots of expensive failures.
It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 13th of September. Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our phone number, thanks, Kathy, for your call, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And the email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we continue with your phone calls. Bud from Planer is next. Hi, Bud.
Hi, I'm from Saner.
Oh, you're from where?
Saner.
Oh, Saner.
Miles north of Madison.
Okay, sure. I know where that is. Yeah.
Your guest has used the word insurgency about 8 times. So I believe he's trying to deliver a message. Would you define the context of insurgency? I associate that with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Where are you coming from on that? And your previous caller...
I think you're reading a little bit too much into it. I mean, I'm
right.
That's a pretty common... I mean, you may not... I don't know whether you approve of it or not, but it's a pretty common term used in politics just to sort of describe sort of outsiders versus insiders. I mean, the insurgents are generally the people that are coming from outside the political establishment. If anything, I mean, it tends to have a positive connotation in politics because it means that you're sort of like the underdog outsider who's got sort of grassroots support as opposed to the establishment, you know, kind of money all tied up. And it's sort of in this cycle, it's kind of a term that's generally used to refer to sort of the Tea Party candidates or the people that are kind of not the people with sort of traditional support the way it's conventionally measured in terms of having had a political career and having had you know, a lot of interest group support and a lot of financial support, but people that are kind of coming from the outside and sort of in some cases sneaking up on the establishment candidates and taking them by surprise.
Let's talk about the economy for a moment. Here's an email. The Bush tax cuts for the wealthy were sold as an economic stimulus. The wealthy would spend their extra money to stimulate growth. Everybody would benefit. These tax cuts, according to Jim, we have yet to see any benefits from them. We have job losses, continued economic decline, and a spread between the rich and the poor. Your comments on whether or not the tax cuts for the very wealthy will expire, if the president will make this a huge issue, and then the broader question is there anything that the president could do to make voters feel that he really wants to do something to create jobs?
Well, taking the second question first, I mean, I think he doesn't have a lot of great options. I mean, part of it's stylistic, obviously. I mean, a lot of people think he could do a better job kind of just on a personal level communicating, and that's easy to say, and it doesn't tell you whether in the end it would really make any difference or not. But when someone's doing poorly politically, you know, everybody says he's doing a bad job communicating, and I guess it sort of goes without saying. But, you know, maybe he could improve his performance in that regard. You know, nobody expects the unemployment rate to magically improve between now and Election Day. I mean, it's sort of close to double digits now, and certainly if it were to go into double digits, which I don't think is expected, that would be pretty, you know, one more huge piece of bad news for the Democrats. I remember in 1982, which was the early, you know, the middle of the first term of Ronald Reagan's first term, there was a really painful recession in this country, and right before the election, the unemployment rate hit double digits. It went from 9 point something to 10 point something. And that was a bad election cycle for Republicans. But these are the kinds of things, you know, he has pretty limited control over at this point in time. In terms of the Bush tax cuts, the White House has signaled that it's going to fight that pretty hard, and wants to let the tax cuts for the wealthiest expire, even though it's a little bit on the political defensive on that issue. There's a little bit of division among Democrats. There, you know, some centrist and conservative Democrats, you know, see that a little differently than the White House. And so it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility, if there's a big Republican tide this fall, to see the White House try to find some sort of compromise where there's at least maybe a temporary extension of the tax cuts for upper income Americans, maybe a longer extension for tax cuts for the so-called middle class tax cuts.
Let's go to Jason on the road. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Hello.
Hello.
So I had a question. Just how do you think, what's a good way to go about increasing transparency in the financing of political campaigns? I mean, some type of real-time quote on the website that says exactly how much is coming in from where, or politician webcams? I mean, I don't know.
Well, you know, a lot of this information is available on the web. I mean, not everybody knows how to access it. You can get, in the federal races, this data through the FEC website, the Federal Election Commission, FEC.gov, and again, it's not all in real time, but you know, there's a lot of material there for people. Certainly, the media has a responsibility and a role to play when it comes to doing this, when it comes to reporting on the money. You know, that's in a sense, you know, the sort of that aspect of covering the campaigns is in competition with other things that. Other aspects of covering campaigns. I mean, if the media spent all its time reporting on campaign finance, then it wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't be covering what the candidates are saying, what, you know, their records, the policy debate, et cetera, et cetera. So it's part of, I think, the information that voters need, and I think arguably the media could do a better job getting that information to people. Whether legislatively something needs to be done to improve reporting, there have been efforts on Capitol Hill to sort of push the Senate in particular toward better electronic reporting. Right now there's a little bit of this, the Senate has one set of rules and the House has one set of rules, and some of the sort of digital reporting, electronic reporting on the Senate side is optional, where it's mandatory on the House side.
I was thinking about something you said earlier about the enthusiasm among Republicans. What are Republicans enthusiastic about? What makes them want to go to the polls tomorrow?
Well, I think, you know, most people would say that opposition is a more powerful incentive than support. And just like in the same way that Democrats were pretty charged up and motivated during the Bush presidency, Republicans are pretty charged up and motivated during the Obama presidency. So enthusiasm is, in this case, another way of saying you're upset and you're angry and you want change. And that you could say is a negative emotion. You're motivated because you don't like what you're seeing. But I think political scientists would probably say that's a more powerful motivator than turning out to vote in sort of because you're motivated to vote in support of the party in power.
Mm-hmm. And the change that you want is what? A change in health care legislation, a change in the tax code, a change in Afghanistan policy, what?
Are you talking about on the Republican side?
Yeah.
I don't think it's a change in Afghanistan policy. I think I think that's one issue where the lines are more blurred between the parties. I think it's partly health care. I think it's spending. It's sort of role of government. I think the powerful kind of theme driving a lot of the side is idea of government overreach and that this belief that government's too big and trying to do too much and spending too much money. And in this case, you know, the history of it is we saw some of that when George Bush was still president, some of that sort of stirrings of kind of conservative unrest because there was a lot of spending going on during that presidency. And we saw certainly a spike in deficit spending. And now, with a Democrat in the White House, I think it's sort of gelled, and I think that's, you know, those are, that constellation of issues is sort of what's driving this on the Republican side.
Jason, thank you. We go to Paula in Janesville. Hi, Paula.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
Kathleen.
Paula.
I'm busy thinking about what I want to say, but I forgot your name.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
You got it right.
Okay.
It's Kathleen.
Yeah, I was looking through my blue book. Some of these people are still in office. A lot of those have qualifications, like in law and political science. And I think our government suffers because of that. And some of these people that want to come in are just coming from their own standpoint of small business and every day, you know, cafe and... I don't know. I think the two clash.
What do you think? Are both qualifications? Would you like to see a combination of those, or what?
Some of them aren't qualified for politics and law, and they compensate with sometimes their biases. And the other side is not very often anymore, it seems like, law and political science, and I think the two get together and conflict.
Oh, okay. I see your point. Craig?
Well, I'm not really sure how to answer that. I think, you know, it'd be interesting to look at, if you looked over time at how this has changed. I mean, certainly if you go back far enough in time, if you look at things, something like the state legislature, you'd see a different profile before the sort of professionalization of the state legislature, a different profile in people's backgrounds. Now it certainly is more, you see more sort of career politicians, professional political people than you did if you go back decades. But I think it's sort of been this way for a while. Wisconsin, of course, is not a term limit state, and that's a whole nother issue. You could get a pretty healthy debate if you about the effect of term limits in states like California and other states where they have them. But there's no question at the state legislative level we've seen a shift over a long period of time in the backgrounds that people bring to public office. And Wisconsin's also a state that has a history of sending people to office for a long period of time, and we sort of forget that in years like this where there's a lot of political turbulence. But the fact is that in the grand scheme of things, you know, the success rate for incumbent politicians running at all levels, particularly for federal office, is pretty amazingly high.
One final email. We have about a minute left from Susan in Norwalk, who has to disagree with you, Craig. She works in a 90-mile radius, and everyone she talks to about the elections, they all bring up points from commercials. They're not checking to see if the points are true or factual. It's very disturbing to think our officials will be elected off commercials.
Well, yeah, I mean, I really wasn't trying to suggest that they weren't important. I think I was just making the point that when it comes to presidential campaigns, they have less relative influence over the outcome than they do. They can be really, really consequential for offices below the level of president. And you know, we try, we're trying to some extent to sort of deal with that in partnering with PolitiFact, the fact-checking mission that newspapers have engaged in, to try to sort of scrutinize what people are saying and let people know, and they can find all this information on our website and let people know whether the claims they're hearing are true or not.
Well, thank you, Craig, so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
We'll talk to you again. Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We thank him for being with us to talk about politics, all things political, with a heavy emphasis this hour because of the primary tomorrow, looking at races here in the state of Wisconsin. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just a moment, and then we'll return and should have a very wonderful conversation about libraries. We all use them and we love them, and we'll find out about all the services they are providing and how many more people all over the country are using libraries and getting library cards in record numbers, even though they don't have as much money as they used to have. So it should be a good conversation. Thanks for calling in, everybody, and for your interest in all things political. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.